Now, Green Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Good day, Montreal. Beryl Wiseman here in studio, President of the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal. With me, as always, Rick McConomy. Montreal, we've talked these past few weeks about the power of you. The ordinary guy in the street, stand up on his own, advocate for himself, take control of his life. Never is that more important than during an election. And this week, we've seen two important elections, one our own and the other in the Middle East, which, as many of you know, has an impact on everything from how secure we feel to the price of oil. This was the ultimate test of the people's vote, the people's ballot, the people's power. And we have a full show for you. We're going to split it up into two segments, one concerning our election and the other we're going to look at the Middle East. And in the first hour, we're going to be joined by John Reynolds, conservative campaign co-chair. We're going to talk about how the West really feels about this election. Is the West really in? Finally in with Chorus Network's Charles Adler. Paul Wells, McLean senior political columnist, will be joining us, as will political analyst John Parasella on the Quebec effect. Second hour, we're going to have Israeli Consul General Mark Attali. Two men, two academics, one who's actually met Hamas leaders, and the second who has been on the ground there as early as 12 months ago, 14 months ago, actually, correct myself, as well as New York Times and Jerusalem Post reporter Noga Tarnopolsky on what the street is talking about. But first, let's get right to it. We want to know from you how you felt about this election. We want to know from those voters who voted Tory why you voted against Mr. Martin, how you felt the tenor of the campaign went, and what do you think the future holds. But first, our first guest is John Reynolds, conservative campaign co-chair, and we'll get to him right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. We're joined by John Reynolds, conservative campaign co-chair, former government house leader, credited by many to be the architect of a flawless campaign. John, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Where was the turning point for you? Where did you feel the movement?
Well, certainly, I think, you know, we felt very positive from the day the election was called, but when the beer and popcorn statement came, you could see a draining of energy from the Liberal side. It was a kick at everybody working on their campaign.
You could see there was a difference between the tone of Stephen Harper and Paul Martin. I think at that point, the civility of Harper and the hysteria of Martin, the hysteria button was pushed quickly, wasn't it, by the Liberals?
Yeah, Harper was calm and cool from start to finish. We had a plan, and he stuck to the plan. He released policy. And then, of course, when the charges were laid by the RCMP, and you had the Prime Minister running off and yelling and screaming that this was just a political vendetta, that was an attack on the RCMP, which I think hurt them greatly. Everybody knows the RCMP doesn't call for a criminal investigation unless they've already done their homework and made sure there's a reason why there should be one. What the NDP and the Tories asked for was just a look at this situation. They looked, they found enough evidence to go ahead with a criminal investigation.
That was a case, a little bit of the pot calling the kettle black, as many listeners will recall. Before the last election, Jean Lapierre tried to muscle the RCMP and use it as an agency of the party by calling for early charges to be laid because it would help them. And now they're not happy that a simple letter was sent out.
That's right. So, you know, those were two major factors in turning a lot of people off. I thought the Prime Minister just never really got into the swing of the campaign. In fact, I had people say on election night when he made his concession speech that if he made a speech like that during the campaign, he would have done better. He always seemed to be yelling during the campaign. His body was in heavy motion and his attacks on Stephen Harper. And even the attacks in the last couple of days, the ads they ran on the abortion, you know, right to choose, were absolutely lies. I mean, the 70%, the quote was 70% of conservatives will vote to take you right away, which is absolutely false. There was as many people in the Prime Minister's caucus who have the same views as some in the conservative caucus on those issues.
And both
are the minority.
John, Rick McConomy in Montreal. Basically, was there a feeling that you were running Harper really much more under control, looking prime ministerial, the five basic points, were they things that were key to the victory?
Well, there's no question with that. He looked like a prime minister from the start. And even our opponents, I remember on election night when I was doing CTV, and Brian Tobin and Joy McPhail, the NDP, and even the Bloc looked at me after Harper's acceptance speech and said, my God, he really looks like a prime minister. He did a good job. He followed the plan, and he put together an exceptional team of people. We didn't have that the last election because we just had managed to merge the parties together and to get through a leadership race. We just weren't ready. But this is a man who learns very quickly when mistakes are made and goes about correcting them. And I think that is going to bid well for this country. I think just a short week, a day less than a week that he's been prime minister-elect, the statements he's made on foreign affairs and other issues are very strong. There's no waffling. There's no doubt in anybody's mind exactly where he stands. And I think Canadians will look forward to that from the prime minister.
There wasn't that I'm very, very concerned. He came out very clearly, candidly, and said, the Americans can take care of their sovereignty. We'll take care of ours. He was clear on Hamas. Democratically elected, yes. But for it to be legitimate, has to renounce violence. End of story.
And that's unusual for Canada.
We haven't seen it in years.
Canada's waffled from as far back as we can remember on foreign affairs, especially. I know Stephen Harper as well as anybody, and you're not going to get waffling from this man. He says what he thinks, and he thinks before he speaks.
It was a proud moment. I know, John, I know Rick has a question for you, because you've been credited with getting a lot of the key candidates in across the country, but particularly in Quebec, into the Tory fold. And I know Rick had a question for you as to how hard that was.
Yeah, how difficult was it to recruit people? I noticed in the cities that there was a certain softness, Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. Is that going to be something that you'll be working on for the next time around?
Oh, there's no question about it. And what sort of hurts me a little when it's all over, Dan Fournier in Outremont, I mean, there's a man who just should be in the House of Commons.
Absolutely.
A man of passion, understands Canada. I remember when he came to see me the first time in Ottawa, I said, I'm thinking of being a candidate, and I tried to talk him into it and told him all the good news and some of the bad news, and that you're not going to make very much money compared to what you've done in the past, but you're going to serve your country. He then proceeded to visit Bernard Lord in the East Coast and Peter Lougheed in the West Coast to find out more about the Conservative Party, made a decision to join, and then I went down to his campaign. I phoned him, and they said, well, you say you're going to go, I'm coming down. So I did. Met his whole campaign team. They had a great team of people. But if he sticks with it, he will get elected. The next election, Harper will get a good majority, and we'll elect a larger number from the province of Quebec.
So you're looking at a 58 or an 85, is that it?
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's what we need. I think the great thing about this election, it's brought the country together. The Liberals have spent 13 years dividing it. They kept on trying to divide the country to stay in power, which is not good for this country. Harper's brought it back together. And yes, we're a little weak. They say we're weak in the cities, but remember, that's only three cities. There's other large cities in this country, like Calgary is actually a larger city than Vancouver now, as a city. It's not in the metropolitan area, but as a city. Calgary, Edmonton, Regina, Saskatoon, Winnipeg, and large cities throughout Ontario and Atlantic Canada. We've elected people in those cities. So it's just that we've been shut out in considered the three major cities. And we've got people in the suburbs of some of them,
only by 3 points in most of those cities. John Reynolds, thank you for your time. I'm only sorry you're not going to be in this house, John. You were a great government house leader. You brought integrity to that post. You never railed for the sake of railing, and you'll be missed. But the country thanks you for your service, John. Thanks for being with us today.
You've got a great prime minister, and I'll be there to help him in the next campaign.
Best of luck, John.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. The new y'all, Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. We're talking about the election, what it meant to you, and how it made you feel. Rick, John Reynolds made an interesting point. He said that it wasn't only that Stephen Harper acted statesmanlike during the campaign, but his first press conference really made people feel proud for the first time. It was really good to hear.
I remember from the House of Commons seeing poor Paul Martin looking like a cheerleader about how we're going to win this election and cheerleading on with his gang around him. And Harper came out, and there he was. He was the statesman. We were going to run an election. We're going to go forward. He stumbled a little at the beginning, and then they hit on those five main points, and he just kept hitting them one after another. And now, this week, he's already announced, yes, the GST is going down by 1%. So the promises and the premises of his victory are deliverables, and he's delivering them A, B, C, and D.
And it was also a breath of fresh air in Montreal, as we'd like to hear what you think. When we heard that the foreign policy content of his first press conference, we remember Martin's trip to Libya, where he called Gaddafi a man with an intellectual bent of mind. And here we had a prime minister who stood up clearly and unequivocally, talked to the Americans, said, we're your friends, but you take care of your own backyard, we'll take care of ours. And as far as Hamas, legitimately elected, fine. They renounce violence, we'll talk. And we've had 12 years of liberal government that wouldn't put Hamas on a terrorist list, even though the European Union and the Americans did.
Well, curiously enough, he declares his independence from the Americans, and then he takes exactly the same stand on Hamas as the Americans have. It's really very...
And the European Union.
Exactly. Very intelligent, very wise method of finding himself right in where he's left off with his election.
We had clarity. And to get to some clarity in the West, we're joined by none other than Canada's greatest talk show host, Corus Network's Charles Adler, heard coast to coast. Charles, thank you for being with us.
You're calling me for clarity? You're calling the wrong number.
I'm calling you for clarity, Charles. Is the West finally in? Are they happy?
The Clarity Act.
Are they happy?
First of all, I'm not going to speak for the West. I'll just speak for myself. I think that many people in Western Canada are happy that it's a change. Many people in Western Canada who were just a little to the right of center were happy. It was a minority. Some people wanted higher numbers, but overall, it's a positive.
Where do we go from here? How represent? Does Stephen Harper have to respond a lot to the West in terms of cabinet making?
No, I don't think people here are bean counting. I mean, they understand that he's got to steer a moderate course, otherwise he doesn't survive. I mean, the West is no different than the East or Central Canada. Those people who understand the Westminster system, the parliamentary system, understand that the power in that system is really in the hands of the opposition, and that you've got to give the opposition something in order to stay in power. I mean, for a while, there's no doubt he can do pretty much whatever he wants, because the Liberals certainly and the Bloc Québécois will not want to bring him down. I can't see the NDP either. So for a year, he may have some latitude. But even in that year, if he tries to do some things in the social area, in the socially conservative area, he may have a problem. But I think what people will find out is that Harper's instincts are not social conservative anyway. He's a libertarian. He's an economic conservative. And my guess is that he'll spend most of his time pushing an economic package along with the Accountability Act.
Now, does that mean a fiscal equilibrium in the pushing from Quebec? Is that going to fly positive or negative in Western Canada?
I think that when it comes to the fiscal imbalance issue, I think he'll deal with it in such a way that it benefits all of the country. I think he's going to devolve powers to the various provinces. But I just wouldn't want anyone listening to this to think that provincial premiers, whether they're in the West or the East or Central Canada, are going to stop bitching just because he offers them a few tax points. You know, when it comes to those kinds of arguments, I don't think the provincial premiers will ever say, thank you very much, that's enough, we can now move forward, because I think they have the federal government there as their bugaboo, as their peeing post, and I think all premiers play that game, and I don't think that's going to stop.
Charles Beryl here. I want you to think about one question, which we'll get to right after this. Is Alberta going to press for the nomination of the elected senators, and will the Senate become a sticking point, particularly for Alberta, if not for the West generally?
I think Alberta will press for that, but once again, I mean, you take it to Alberta. No Albertan has a notion that just because you have a couple of those senators elected, that you're going to have a U.S.-style Senate where the Senate has the kind of powers that I think that the Senate ought to have. I mean, unless you have an equal, effective Senate. It's just not going to matter. I mean,
Charles, we'll be right back to finish this discussion on the political issues facing Stephen Harper right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. The new talk, Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. We're talking about the election and how you feel about it. We've had John Reynolds on. We have Charles Adler on the air. How did you vote? Why did you vote? How much of it was personal? Was it the hysterical fear of the Liberals versus the statesmanlike hope of the Conservatives? Did that sway you? Or was it just what my father and my grandfather did? And let's get back to Charles Adler of Corus Networks. Charles, thank you for staying with us. I wanted to ask you, there's this, you had that remarkable run-in with this host, this radio host from Halifax, who basically said anybody who votes Tory is like voting for the Nazis. And I recommend to all our listeners, by the way, to go to charlesadler.com and read a magnificent column that Charles wrote in response to that. What kind of a mindset in the East has, where does that mindset come from, Charles?
What do you mean by the mindset in the East? This is
well, the
Ontario,
mindset of that.
Ontario, this is an Ontario-based host who just happens to work there because that's where he's been able to.
But you know, we hear a lot of that in Toronto. We hear a lot of that in Ontario, in Montreal, in the 416 and the 5014. There was this fear of Harper in the last election. It was reduced this year, but this time around. But it's what is it about Canadians that they can't handle two sets of ideologies without absolutely demonizing one?
Well, no, it's just I think it's just a path of least resistance. When the Liberals found for years they could simply argue against the Reform Party, the Alliance, now the Conservatives, by demonizing them, by attaching them to the worst demons in history, and they knew that it worked, especially on certain ethnic populations. They just kept doing it. I mean, it's much easier to throw a label around than to frame an argument.
Basically, you said earlier on some of the social issues that Harper's going to have to be careful with, same-sex marriages, the reoccurring bubbles on abortion and the bubbling up of that issue. You think he's going to leave those totally aside, and can he manage that?
Well, let's face it, he can whip his cabinet like anybody else does, and he's not going to be forwarding legislation. He's not going to be advancing legislation. So if you have the odd member of the caucus raising a private member's bill, you've always had that kind of thing. As you know, very few private member's bills ever become legislation. None of those issues that you've talked about are going to become part of the legislative pipeline, because if they do, they'll distract Harper from his agenda. They'll take over. They'll suck up all the oxygen. And politically, what they'll do is give credence to the Liberal scare campaigns. If Harper tries that, Harper will be a very short-term leader. He'll be another Joe Clark, and the Liberals will be in for another 8 or 12 years.
Does he have deniability on those things?
Well, of course he does. He has the power to draft legislation or not to. And if he's the architect of his own agenda, if he's the architect of new legislation, then he's got choices.
So one of my gay friends that said I have a right and they're going to take it off of me should be sleeping quietly tonight in the reassurance that it's too hot an issue for them to reopen.
I don't think that any individual gay person in this country honestly thinks that Stephen Harper is going to deny him of rights tomorrow or the next day or the next day. Look at the power that gay votes had in the major cities of Canada. It's an issue that isn't discussed very often post-election. But you can't deny that the gay vote that is centered in the large areas in the three biggest cities in Canada had influence. You can't deny that most of those went to the Liberals. That hurt the Tories. The last thing Stephen Harper needs to do is to frame himself as a permanently anti-gay leader of an anti-gay party. He has, once again, the choice to do that or not to do that. I don't think any intelligent person, gay or otherwise, is sitting there right now thinking that that's something that Harper wants to do. Which party wants to be the anti-gay party? I don't see it.
Charles, thanks very much for joining us. Montreal, you can hear Charles Adler every day, Monday to Friday, 2 to 5, the voice of Chorus Network on 10 stations. Charles, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Beryl.
Thanks, Charles.
Okay.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Good day, Montreal. We've been discussing the election, what it means to you. Are you finally comfortable with the fact that there really are two legitimate federal parties in Canada? And no, nobody's wearing the costume of the devil. We're joined now by Paul Wells, Maclean senior political columnist. Good afternoon, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Beryl. How are you?
Good. Paul, so are the chattering classes in Ottawa and all the bureaucrats now have their sphincter muscles concentrated and a little worried about their jobs?
Well, I mean, the very limited discussions I've had with bureaucrats, they're kind of two minds. I mean, they have spent 13 years working for Liberals, and it's got their head in a certain place, and they're used to a certain kind of program. They're not sure that they like what the Conservatives plan to do, but I've talked to a couple who are quite impressed with the way the Conservatives are doing it. Stephen Harper and his transition team have arrived at the plan, and they're very specific, and they're very focused, and they're interested in having real conversations. Already the briefing sessions have been real sessions of give and take. Like, Harper's not
And Derek Burney, who's head of the transition team, is well known, and they must be comfortable with him.
Well, this is it. I mean, reformers are hardly shut out of this party. It's a party where members of the old Reform Party are welcome and have key roles, like Ian Brody, who probably will be Harper's chief of staff. But for the transition, for the sort of arrival into adulthood of this party, a lot of the old Tories, the Mulroney gang, are being used because they have experience with these questions. They know the give and take that you have to have as you're moving, from opposition into power and from a platform into government.
Paul, we've got Daniel on the line who says the country is more divided than ever. Daniel, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, but we have to understand that when you do a post-mortem analysis of what has happened, Canada is more divided than ever because the whole power is now concentrated in the West. And not even
Daniel, turn down your radio.
Sorry.
Daniel, turn down your radio.
And not even in Vancouver area alone, but only in Alberta. And we all know that there's a conservative government in Alberta. And therefore, there's no doubt to me that, Calgary has voted en masse.
Well, Daniel, but the Conservative Party is represented in all the provinces and all the regions, and we thank you for your opinion. Rick, you had a question for Paul.
A journalistic question, Paul. Can you explain how the McLean's magazine ends up running four pages on Sheila Martin the weekend before the election?
Yeah, she said yes to an interview.
She said a week before the election.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
At the same time that CTV ran this glorified little profile of Paul Martin hard at work for the country.
Let me ask Rick, are you saying that McLean's was campaigning for Paul Martin? Because I'd be delighted if you are, because all I hear is that we're a right-wing rag.
No, all I'm saying is I think it's a desperate running out of what to put in the four pages.
Really?
I mean,
if you can find a news organization in this country that would turn down an interview with the Prime Minister's wife, let me know about them, and I'll tell you a news organization that can't find news.
Well said. I was curious to know how you guys stand on that. She gave the acceptance what, and scheduled it for the 7th of January, if I read right?
Yeah, I think so.
And then it ran from there?
Yeah.
It seemed just a little strange, the four pages, and of course she was like hot and cold about being in politics in the article.
Yeah. Well, I found it a very interesting interview precisely because she has, I mean, you get political wives who are about five times as political as their husbands, and love a crowd, and like Mila Mulroney, and in a very different way, like Aileen Cretchen. And then you get spouses like Sheila Martin, who is a woman of extraordinary qualities and really involved in the community, but frankly seemed to be hating every minute of it.
John, we've been reading in the press, particularly, I believe the Globe and Mail had an article on this, that this is going to be a more user-friendly PMO, particularly toward the press. Are you feeling any of that right now, that it's not going to be as paranoid and as closed a shop as it was?
I expect it to be at least as paranoid.
At least as paranoid.
At least as paranoid.
God help us.
The people around Harper, their sort of ground assumption, their opening assumption is that we don't need to know stuff. And you really have to get sit them down and explain very patiently why we actually have to know stuff. And I'm finding that one of the best explanations is if they don't tell us the news, we'll make stuff up.
That's a good threat. That's
that tends to make them open up a bit.
Amazing. Is it going to be a big change in atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean the biggest change is from a party that, under Paul Martin, didn't know what it wanted to do specifically. And now we have a party that does specifically know what it wants to do. And I think it's told us some of that. But in terms of the changes to federalism, in terms of how excited the Charest government is in Quebec City, because they think they finally got a government in Ottawa that sees things their way, I think it's going to be a very interesting time and a lot of surprises. And one of the big surprises is, anyone who thinks this guy Harper is going to be a pushover, they have not yet learned.
Has something else in store. Paul Wells, thank you for joining us from Ottawa. Paul Wells, senior political columnist for McLean's, and I recommend his blog called Inkless Wells, where he does some more great writing. Paul, thanks very much for joining us. We'll be right back to discuss the Quebec effect.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Call the Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. Beryl Wiseman, Rick McConomy in studio with me, and we have gone across the country on this election roundup, and now we're bringing it home to you, Montreal. The Quebec effect was very important, not only the Conservative breakthrough, but what did it mean to the Bloc? What did it mean to you as voters? How did you vote? You obviously no longer voted just for the Liberals as your one and only savior. And with us on this issue of the Quebec effect is well-known political analyst John Parasella, who served at one point as chief of staff to Robert Bourassa. And joining us as well is Nino Colavecchio, president of the National Italian Congress in Quebec, and a man who has some very interesting views to share on how the non-Anglophone communities, the non-Francophone communities, are reacting to the options. First, we go to John. John, how are you, and thank you for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here, Beryl.
John, what's this Quebec effect? What is the effect? Is it the rise of the Tories as an alternative to the Liberals as a Federalist option, or is this the combination of the Federalist vote actually was greater than the Bloc vote? What was more important here? Where was the breakthrough in Quebec?
Well, I think it's probably both to some extent equally, but I do think that the rise of the Conservative Party at this stage of the game is certainly interesting, because before this election was called, the Bloc basically had two objectives. One was to up the total to 50% plus one to give them the psychological edge that they had never occurred to them in any previous election or referendum. So that was extremely important. The second one, of course, was to demonize even more the Liberal Party, knowing or feeling that the Liberal Party probably would end up winning a minority government. They failed on both accounts. So in that sense, it's negative, and they dropped from 49 to 42%. So essentially, the big loser in this campaign has been the Bloc, because now the Bloc would be very fearful to force the fall of a Tory government in the short term, because knowing the way Quebecers would probably react at this stage of the game, they would probably revert towards the Conservative Party at this stage of the game. So it's certainly not good news for the sovereignists. It's not the end of the push towards sovereignty,
John,
that's for sure.
John, is this not also a failure of the Liberals to maintain their status as the Federalist option?
Well, for sure. The Liberals, of course, suffered from everything that was related to the various scandals. There's no doubt about it. Plus, I think the fact that there was a certain arrogance that was felt all along. And I think that's the problem with the Liberals in constitutional relations with Quebec governments, whether they are Federalist or even Sovereignist. There's always been a sense that the Liberals have always felt that the Federal Liberals, that is, have always felt that they possessed the truth on these issues, and they're out of sync. I mean, let's face it, Trudeau was the last federal Liberal leader who was able to win the majority of the seats in Quebec. The last Liberal federal leader to win the majority of seats in a federal election in Quebec, and that occurred in 1979. So we're now talking something like over 25 years ago. Ever since then, the Tories won, of course, two elections with Mr. Mulroney, and the Bloc have won the majority of seats in every election.
John, I want to get Nino in on this point. Nino, is this Liberal arrogance or a knock on the Bloc?
I think what we have is a situation where the press is having a lot of fun picking on Gilles Duceppe, because, of course, he made that over-enthusiastic statement about 51%, and in the heat of action, these things do happen. But if you look at the situation as it is, the Bloc did lose some feathers in this election, but yet they retained their traditional sovereignist vote, and what has happened is that the Federalist vote, now that was... those that wanted to protest, the Liberals, no longer parked themselves with the Bloc, but had an option. And the option was the Conservative vote. And so we saw a shift. But if you look at the percentages, the Bloc has retained their traditional sovereignist vote. And that's the important issue.
The old core of 40%.
The 40% core that has been there all along.
But nothing more.
Well, this was not an
sorry,
election.
John, yes?
Yeah, well, I understand what Nino is saying, and he's right to say that it's a percentage very similar to what the 1980 referendum indicated, which was about 41% in favor of the yes vote then. But the fact of the matter is they lost the Quebec City region. They lost votes in the Francophone hinterland. So for sovereignists, this is not a good sign. I mean,
we'll get right back to this, John, and on this debate on what it means for Quebec right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Now, Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Hello, Montreal. We're back. Rick McConaughey in studio with Nino Colavecchio. We've got John Parasol on the line, and we're talking about the Quebec effect. What did this election mean to you, Montreal? Is it a new day for the Tories? Is it a bad day for the Bloc? Has anything shifted seismically? And we're going back to a discussion between John and Nino where they were a little bit at loggerheads here as to whether this is a knock on the Bloc or just a destruction of the Liberals because of their arrogance. John, I think you had the next word coming up.
Well, I think we have to say that both the Bloc and the Liberals displayed a lot of arrogance in the last campaign. The Bloc seemed to be possessing the truth about Quebec, claimed that they represented Quebec practically alone, and they talked a lot about so-called Quebec values that were different from what was being propagated outside of Quebec. And, of course, the Liberals, they feel that they possess the truth as well when it comes to federal-provincial relations, relationship with Quebec, and also the notion of Canadian values. So I think between the two poles of arrogance seem to have been at least some modesty that came through, and I think in that sense the Tories came out pretty strong. Now the jury will be out on them, of course.
I thought Quebecers like passion.
Passion and arrogance are not equivalent.
Quite right.
I mean, I think the Tories said the things that Quebecers wanted to hear. Clearly, reform of federalism is the preferred option of all Quebecers in every single poll that's been taken for the last.
Well, Nino's itching here. He's itching.
I think we need to give Stephen Harper and the Conservatives the credit they deserve for the way they ran their campaign. They told Quebecers that voting for the Bloc was not going to give him anybody in Ottawa that could actually affect change, and voting for the Liberals was a no-starter because of the corruption, and the only way that they would have a say in what went on in Ottawa was to vote for the Conservatives. So they ran a positive campaign in that sense. Does that mean that they suddenly converted all the sovereigntists to a Conservative cause? I think we're far, far from that. If in fact, Gilles Duceppe had not made that unfortunate statement of 51%, he would be rejoicing today in the fact that the Bloc holds the balance of power in
Rick,
Ottawa.
Should Gilles Duceppe be rejoicing at anything?
Yuck. This is the first time
where
everybody agreed they were going to solve fiscal equilibrium.
Montreal, prior Rick McConaughey said yuck.
They would not even get into fiscal equilibrium. They denied it existed. Suddenly, all of them in the debate are saying, I'm going to fix fiscal equilibrium. If Charest and Harper fix fiscal equilibrium, goodbye Liberals, goodbye Bloc Québécois. If that's the thing that needs fixing,
John Paracelli, is that an issue? Is that really that much of a hardcore bread and butter street level issue, this fiscal imbalance?
No, I think it's very much symbolic of the fact that federal and Quebec relations aren't functioning the way they should, and that's what is the flavor of the day today. It's fiscal imbalance. A few years ago was distinct society, and so there's always a new flavor of the month. It is important, and I agree with Rick McConaughey when he says that if there is a solution that can be found to what is a very complex problem, it won't be found in one day, in one meeting, and in one signing of the check. But let us say there is a general consensus in Quebec that this file has moved forward, then clearly the Tories had the chance to really become the strong federalist alternative to the traditional Liberal vote at the federal level. And I think in that sense it's certainly an opportunity for Mr. Harper. I disagree with Nino when he says that Duceppe would be rejoicing. Let's not kid ourselves.
John, we're not going to kid ourselves, and I know you don't kid anybody. Well, thank you for being with us, and we are going to be We're joined by Pat McAdam from Ottawa on the Mulroney Factor right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. What did this election mean to you? Let's hear from you. 790-0006 in studio here with me is Rick McConaughey and Nino Colavecchio. And on the line from Ottawa, Pat McAdam of the Ottawa Sun. Pat, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, let me just tell Montrealers about you. Pat goes way back in politics and knows everything about almost everybody. You were, I believe you were Brian Mulroney's roommate at St. Francis Xavier, and you served in the PMO.
No, I wasn't his roommate. We were there.
You were there at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
And you served in his PMO?
Yes. Yeah.
Pat, we wanted to chat with you about what's been called the Mulroney factor. We know that, Senator Marjorie Le Breton has been was on the phone with the Prime Minister Mulroney and directing certain aspects of the campaign. How important a role did that factor play?
Well, I talked to Marjorie two nights ago. Marjorie said she never missed a heartbeat. She was on the campaign bus and plane from day one. And so was Senator Pierre-Claude Nolin, who was a key Mulroney supporter in the leadership campaign in 1983 and the election of 1984. And so was Huey Siegel, who was chief of staff to Prime Minister Mulroney back in the 80s. So they were competent and capable and ever-present advisors.
But Nolin, Mulroney, Siegel, it's a pretty good cross-section of people who understand Quebec.
Yeah.
That's some credit to them, a lot of credit to them for the breakthrough.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's it's a mug's game when you get into your 60s like they are and traveling 56 days on a bus or an aluminum cocoon in the air, and it's tiring. I went through it in 84, 55 days away from home. And
Pat, Nino's got a question on that.
How much of the Conservatives' newfound openness to Quebec issues can be attributed to the Mulroney factor?
As I said in my column this morning, crow isn't bad if you have it with a little HP sauce and some chips and gravy. I advised Stephen Harper in a couple of columns that you can win without Quebec and don't waste your time. It's a wasteland. I was more surprised than anyone else when he won 10 seats. And they took 2 seats from the Liberals and 8 from the Bloc. And don't forget, there are also spoilers in 7 other ridings that the Bloc won.
Pat, you weren't meaning to suggest in your columns that Stephen forget about Quebec, merely that the possibility of an electoral victory is there by the numbers.
Diefenbaker was told by Gordon Churchill in 57, don't waste your money and your resources and your time, and Quebec is a wasteland. George Drew won 2 seats. John Bracken won 2 seats, and George Drew won 4, and Diefenbaker won 8 or 9 in 57. So Gordon Churchill says you can win a majority without Quebec.
Yep. So Rick McConomy knows a bit about that 57-58 period.
In 58, he hooked up with the Duplessis machine, and he swept the province.
He won 50 seats in 58.
Did extremely well in Quebec thanks to a connection between
Duplessis.
Brokered by my father-in-law, the late Pierre Sevigny.
Oh, yeah.
Where can we see the Conservatives forming alliances? Where can we see them growing organizationally on the ground? With whom?
Well, Or is
it going to be up to the quality of the candidates they get riding by riding?
Well, I heard Brian Mulroney say 40 years ago that Quebec was always one election behind the rest of the country. They gave Diefenbaker 9 seats and 57 and 50 seats in, when they saw him as a winner in 58.
There you go, yeah.
So what's going to happen? I don't know. Maybe Stephen Harper is poised to crush the Bloc to become the new face of federalism in Quebec.
You just made Nino's face turn purple, so we'll go to our resident gadfly, Nino Colavecchio. Stephen Harper, Pat McAdam just suggested, may be poised to crush the Bloc. Federal, what do you think?
There's nothing like new love, Beryl. The man is in. We give him, the honeymoon is on. He can solve all the problems. He will slay the sovereignist dragon with one clean swell. Well, the ball is in his court, and he's set the bar pretty high. He's actually going to attempt to resolve all the issues in Quebec and do so by solving the fiscal deficit. I just say that let's wait and see. Let's give him the time to...
If he makes the effort, Nino, he's going to get the credit. He doesn't have to produce the result.
Well, I think that we need results, McConnell.
Pat McAdam, what results would be the first that Quebec would look for from a Harper administration?
Well, the old catchword back in Davy Fulton's days and Diefenbaker's days was cooperative federalism.
Was Stephen Harper's December speech in Quebec City that evidence of that?
I think it was conciliatory,
Just conciliatory or even better?
Reaching out.
If we're harking back, we can also talk about the northern vision that John Diefenbaker had. And this week we heard about the north from Harper.
Well, I worked for Diefenbaker from 59 to 63 as a bag carrier, gopher, and speechwriter. Diefenbaker was hypnotic. Television was in its infancy.
It was the only channel in town. There were no other channels to watch, so people were glued to their TV sets.
And today we've got a new game in town. Pat McAdam, we thank you for joining us, and good luck to you. Pat McAdam of the Ottawa Sun, read his column. It's terrific stuff, and say hello to our friend Mike Duffy, Pat. And we'll be right back talking about the other election, Hamas in the Middle East, right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. And now we're switching to a very different type of election. The one in the Middle East, the one in Palestine that saw the Hamas brought to power as the ruling authority in the Arab state of Palestine, the Arab Authority. This has been described as a political earthquake. They beat the previous governing party, Fatah. We want to hear from you how you think how dangerous you think it is. 7900006. But first of all, we want to introduce our first guest, and we thank you for being with us, Israeli Consul General Mark Attali. Mark, I know you're very pressed for time, and I thank you for taking these minutes out to talk to us.
Thank you. Shalom to you and all the listeners of your program.
Shalom to you. Mark, this is an earthquake. What I want to know from you, how cautiously will Israel be proceeding right now, and what signs are they looking for? Obviously, Hamas has to renounce violence, but short of that, is there anywhere to go with the peace process right now?
Well, it is. One is sure, it's really an earthquake, and it's a new situation in the Middle East, and definitely it's a new situation when it comes to the relation between Israelis and Palestinians. And let's not forget what Hamas is about. Hamas is terrorism, Hamas is incitement, Hamas is anti-Semitism, Hamas, an organization that is carried out more than 100 large-scale terrorist attacks, in which more than 500 Israelis were murdered, thousands were wounded, and he never hid his responsibility.
There's another layer with Hamas. They've admitted to sponsoring 60 suicide attacks. They've admitted to launching the rockets against Israel. But there's this religious overlay when you read their 1988 covenant, and they call all of Palestine an Islamic waqif, and they can only be ruled by Islamic clerics. So they want to make a theocratic tyranny. Is this Iran at the doorstep of the only democracy in the Middle East?
Well, definitely Iran is also a great supporter of Hamas, and in some of the recent terror attacks in Israel, we definitely saw the Iranian fingerprint. And what is also interesting today, which is also dangerous, that you have on the northern part of Israel, you have the Hezbollah, which is supported both by the Iranians and the Syrians. And now you have the Hamas, which is also supported by the Iranians. So it's very, very preoccupying, the situation. And I'm afraid that we might find ourselves like going backward years, even like before the Oslo Agreement, when Israel had no partner to deal with. And this is not a positive development in the region.
Even if Hamas were to make a declaration renouncing violence, does not this theocratic overlay of the way they want to run the government, we just had on the front page of the Globe and Mail their future education minister saying we're going to have girls and boys separated, because he says, and I quote, we've looked at Sweden, which has the greatest amount of co-education but also the highest rate of suicide, so therefore we're going to keep boys and girls apart in school. I mean, that's like saying if you have the biggest state pension plan and you got other problems, then you don't have a pension plan. How do you, even if they renounce violence, how do you deal with them on the theocratic level, which they claim they want to make state law?
You know something, I'm not intent now to kind of enter into a kind of negotiation, what will Hamas do in order for Israel to recognize Hamas, etc., etc., because I will tell you something, and the history of the Middle East and the history of the relation between Israelis and Palestinians showed us that declarations don't stand, which means that we had enough with declarations. Everything must be proved by actions. And for the time being, what Hamas demonstrated, that he's willing to do anything. And you just cited the covenant of Hamas, calling for the destruction of the state of Israel, calling for the implementation of the Sharia law. I also read the interview with Yes, it, on the Globe and Mail.
Yes, it was very frightening. It was a reflection of Khartoum. No negotiation, no recognition, no peace. It was a reflection of Khartoum 30 years ago. Consul General Mark Attali of Israel, thank you for being with us. I know your schedule's tight, and we'll be back right after this with a report from Jerusalem.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This new 940 Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. Studio Rick McConomy, Nino Colavecchio, and we're talking about the earthquake in the Middle East, the Hamas election. And Montrealers, you know that this is not something far away and distant with no relation to your lives. It concerns everything from our security, world stability, to the price of oil, and the price of oil concerns everything else. We just finished discussing with Israeli Consul General Mark Attali the problem of how do you get over, around, or through this newly elected party. They have stated that there will be no recognition, no negotiation, no peace. They refuse to renounce violence, and they insist on imposing a theocratic tyranny. Pretty scary stuff for Canadians. Pretty scary stuff for the world right now. We wanted to know what the street in the Middle East has to say about this, and what the reaction, not of the diplomats necessarily, the politicians, but the people on the street. We have online Noga Tarnopolsky, internationally renowned journalist, award-winning journalist. She's written for the New York Times and Jerusalem Post. And Noga, how are you? Thank you for joining us.
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very well. Noga, so what's the street saying? How nervous
are
people?
Are you talking about the Palestinian street?
Well, since you're in Jerusalem and you go between the two, let's hear the two.
You know, in a way it's similar. I think people are both surprised and not surprised. In Israel, what you hear is, on the one hand, a lot of trepidation, and on the other hand, a sort of weird, almost cynical sense that maybe it's not bad that Hamas won, because A, the world will now see what the face of Palestinian politics is really like in a way that so far only we Israelis have seen it.
In other words, let them hang themselves.
Let them hang themselves, and in another way, a similar message I would say to Europe, that in many Israelis perceive have had some sort of a flirtation with extremist Islamic political movements. The other feeling is, let's see Hamas have to deal with it. In other words, they've been in this sort of luxurious position all along, criticizing everyone, filled with major slogans, but now they're going to have to make sure the roads are paved and people go to school and there are buses, and let's see how they manage in a world in which Realpolitik nevertheless rules. I would say those are the two things on the Israeli street.
We've been seeing on Western TV screens Fatah and Hamas factions knocking the heck out of each other. We've seen Hamas guys storm the parliament and tear down the Palestinian flag because it's not the Hamas banner. Fatah guys in Gaza shooting at Hamas parties. How do you pave the streets? How do you even have a conversation with the foreman to pave the streets when nobody's talking to each other on the Palestinian side?
Look, those are the big questions, Beryl. And I have a friend in Gaza who I spoke with today who told me his feeling is that it's a revolution, but revolution brings chaos. And in part, what you're describing are the very violent fringes of deep ambivalence we see among Palestinians, especially those people who really are torn in that they themselves are not really Islamic fanatics or not necessarily major supporters of terror, but wanted so badly to kick what they perceived as the corrupt, irresponsible, impotent Fatah out of there.
Noga, I want to continue this right after this break. I want to continue what the Palestinian guy in the street has to say about this government and how they're going to react. We'll be back with Noga Tarnopolsky from Jerusalem, Rick McMonomy, and Nino Colavecchio right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're the new, now, Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
We're back, and we're talking about the threat to peace in the Middle East, the threat of the Hamas election. We know from a lot of you listeners, you've written to us at info at IEPM.ca how concerned you are for the security of the Middle East, the security of Israel. We're on, and we'd like to hear from you about that at 790-0006. We're on right now with Noga Tarnopolsky, journalist from Jerusalem. And Noga, where we left off was, and I was asking you about what the Palestinians in the street have to say. The Palestinian community is perhaps the least theocratic or theological among Arab Middle East societies. How is the average Palestinian reacting to, yeah, we know a factor was the protest vote against Fatah's corruption, in quotations, but surely they realized Hamas's violence and theocracy would be as it, if not more, anathema. What were they hoping?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why you're saying corruption in quotation marks. I think the corruption was very, very grave and lasted basically...
I'm saying it in quotation marks because it is the Middle East on both sides of the divide.
In this case, it was obscene and extreme, and given... you're right.
When I mean both sides, Israeli and Palestinian, I mean corruption in government is not the it doesn't make a seismic shift over to the theocratic right and violence.
Not you know what? In this case, the Palestinian people that you're right to say are definitely not the most theocratic in this region. But given that they had two choices, which were basically Fatah or Hamas. After 10 years of what basically they perceive as some version of hell, chose Hamas. One interesting factor to think of when you're talking about this corruption in or not in quotation marks is the point that many people have been saying, just, you know, your average people, when you confront them with the fact that the European community and the United States and the international community on the whole may now completely sever any financial donations, their attitude is, that's fine. We haven't seen a penny of all the donations that have been coming in. It all ended up in foreign bank accounts anyway.
Sure, so, but they were complicit in that as well. There's $40 billion sitting in Switzerland, thanks to Arafat.
Who was complicit? Your average Palestinian is...
No. Hamas, as an organization, was involved in that as well.
Right. That is correct.
It wasn't just Arafat and Fatah.
You're right, although by and large it was. And now the onus to prove clean hands and the ability to properly govern is going to be on Hamas. It's unclear whether or not they have the ability to succeed. Another huge factor is it's unclear if they really try to impose Islamic laws, especially, for example, on women, on, you know, one member of, the senior member of Hamas today was talking about having unmixed schools now, boys and girls separately. If they try to impose this on what's basically a secular population, you may see a real revolt.
Didn't you love the reason why they did that? Because he said that that Sweden has the highest rate of co-education and the highest rate of suicide, therefore 2 + 2 = 5, so we shouldn't have it. Of course, he didn't want to say that it's because of their theocracy. Rick, I think you had a question.
Rick McConomy, Noga. Basically, after all of this happens, I mean, we were watching on the news here the Fatah in the street protesting their leadership for having lost and protesting leadership's performance.
Isn't that interesting? They're not protesting against Hamas. Even Fatah activists have been protesting against Fatah leadership.
Right. I found that very interesting. But the second question is, being so integrated, like 700,000 people that work on the other side, you've got to go through the checkpoints, you've got to go back and forth. The level that the guy and the woman on the street have to live, how much is that going to be affected by this?
And also the fact that one-third of the workforce in Palestine is civil service. And I believe a paycheck is due this Friday, Noga. Am I right?
Yeah. You're right, although paychecks have not been paid for several months, as a result of which we've seen these kind of increasing kidnappings, brief but dangerous kidnappings of foreigners, especially in Gaza, and we've seen takeovers of Palestinian administrative buildings. All of that is correct. I have no idea. I don't think anyone can honestly tell you that they know it, whether or not the Palestinian Authority is going to be able to issue their next paychecks. And in terms of, I understand the previous question had to do with the average guy or woman on the Israeli street. Is that right?
And the Palestinian street.
On the both. There's employment across the the divide. There's families that must be divided.
Honest answer is that nobody knows. Israeli papers yesterday and today are filled with kind of hair-raising speculations, for example, are we now going to, we being Israel, now going to have to issue special security passes issued on a pro forma basis to senior Palestinian officials for senior Hamas officials who by their own ideology could be carrying bombs. Are we going to have to issue them special passes into Israel the way senior Palestinian officials have been issued them routinely? I mean, everything is up in the air.
In other words, the whole equilibrium is, we're now at a new level and we're sitting on a tinderbox.
Right, and interestingly, Angela Merkel, the new chancellor of Germany, is visiting here tonight, and what I was listening to on the radio waiting for you guys to pick me up is, basically, a very unusual, I would say very unusually open public conversation between our acting prime minister, Ehud Olmert, and the chancellor of Germany, basically publicly saying, well, we're going to work in concert, but we're going to play it by ear because we have no idea yet what's going to happen.
Noga Tonopolsky, thank you from Jerusalem, and you can jpost.com. You could see some of Noga's columns in the Jerusalem Post. Noga, thank you very much. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. Montreal, let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. Hamas election, Middle East on a tinderbox. Let's hear from you. We know you're worried about what's going on. 790-0006. Joining Rick McConomy, Nino Colavecchio, and myself is David Romano. Now, David, Professor Romano is a specialist in Middle East studies. David, unbelievably, was on the ground in the Kurdish area of Turkey and Iraq and Syria as early as 14, 15 months ago. David, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
And he is with the Université de Montréal, Centre d'études internationales. And he has a new book out called The Kurdish National Movement from Cambridge University Press, which I highly recommend, and is a specialist in Arab and pan-Arab nationalism. David, how bad on the ground is all this?
Well, there's a lot of Palestinians who are extremely worried. There's secular Palestinians who don't know what to make of this. The last election results I saw, Hamas actually took only around 41% of the vote, but the Fatah vote was split between independents and the Fatah party, and they lost it.
But the representation system gave them the 75 votes.
Exactly. More seats, some 60% of the seats.
So you're telling me that they're about as screwed up with their electoral system as we are.
Exactly.
Now, gerrymandering is not something only in North America.
No, but
they have it on two levels, right? They have a proportional representation system and then a writing system.
Exactly. Now, but the thinking of a lot of observers is, while Hamas was in the opposition, they could snipe and criticize and blow up a bus full of Israeli civilians just when negotiations were proceeding. Now maybe it's good that they're taking power, they'll have to act more responsibly. I'm not sure they can. The whole basis of the movement is a maximalist position, completely rejecting Israel and claiming all of the land. And I can just read you two sentences from their charter. It says, there is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. Initiatives, proposals, and international conferences are all a waste of time and vain endeavors. I don't know how they're going to compromise on that.
David, Rick McConomy has a question for you.
Where does the U.S. Initiatives and the various attempts of intervention through presidential and what are the Oslo and all the rest of it, where does all that stand? Is all that gone?
Well, it may be. That remains to be seen. I think they'll probably have a meeting with some Hamas leadership behind closed doors and see where they're going to go. And they may well walk away from that meeting and say, there's no point in contributing assistance for building schools and clinics if they're going to be destroyed in a polarized conflict, more polarized than since a long time between the Israelis and the new Palestinian Authority. And they may just sit back and wait to see what happens.
Do we end up with an entire country behind camps?
And a lot of innocent Palestinian and Israeli civilians are going to get caught in the middle.
David, thank you very much. David Romano is not just an academic who talks the talk or writes books. He was actually detained in lovely places like Iraq and Syria when he was doing his work there. So he survived this.
Thank you, David. We'll be following up certainly with this over the coming weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Now, Montreal, We're out of here. This has been The Last Angry Man. I want to thank Rick McConomy, Nino Colavecchio, former president of the National Italian Congress. I want to thank all our guests. Canada, this time, you were not the society of sheep, and you didn't hopefully elect the government of wolves. Email us at info@iapm.ca, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. The Last Angry Man can be heard Sundays from noon to 2. Beryl Wiseman is the president of the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal.